It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law here on the Talk Station. You can call in with your questions and your local numbers, too, 247-7282 in Carter, Craven, and Pamlico County, and in Onslow County, 353-4674. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning,
Ben. Good morning,
Ben.
All right, what are we talking about today?
Well, Ben, last week we talked a little bit about just the tip of the iceberg regarding maybe getting into fiduciary litigation, that kind of thing.
State administration
questioning mm-hmm. maybe a will or questioning a deed that was signed or questioning mm-hmm. use of a power of attorney and questioning how the fiduciaries being the executors of an estate have administered an estate and whether they've done it correctly. And a lot of times,
how they handle the money.
And a lot of times, oh my goodness, we get these questions very often, Ben, from people who say, you know, my aunt or my uncle or my brother or my sister is the executor and mm-hmm. they won't tell me anything. Mm-hmm. And I think they're not doing this right.
Right.
And, you know, they are.
He's all of a sudden driving a new car.
They're helping themselves, yeah. you know. Yeah. And I tell you just the sentiment about that when the people come in and sit down and talk with us about these type cases is they feel absolutely helpless.
Mm-hmm.
Feel like, wait, they're the executor.
Right.
What can I do about it?
Right.
I've just got to sit back and let them do what they're going to do and hope that it's all right. And that's not accurate at all.
Would we say this is a question of standing? Is that what we're talking
about?
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, if you're someone who is just unhappy with the way your next door neighbor is doing something mm-hmm. with regard to an estate and you don't have any interest in the estate, of course, you don't have any standing to argue about it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, normally these are inner family, type situations.
Right.
But, you know, when we get to the point when we're looking at the responsibility of the fiduciary and we're looking at what the fiduciary is doing, you know, the first thing that we do in representing these type clients is, of course, we get a copy of the entire estate file. A lot of people don't recognize and don't realize that the estate file, when an estate is mm-hmm. is going through the process of estate administration, is public record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can call the courthouse, no matter what county it is, get a copy of it, and see the inventories that are filed and, mm-hmm. and see the will that was put on record and see how the funds have been used or at least how they're being reported
mm-hmm.
to be used.
Now, right.
Sometimes we find that the documents that are filed aren't necessarily consistent with the actions that the fiduciary took.
And those are based on some timetables, like you mentioned, the 90-day filing, right?
Yeah.
90-day inventory.
Right. And usually there's a preliminary or initial inventory that's mm-hmm. kind of a guess, you know, a good educated guess about what we think the assets are. And then we might have a, you know, an interim inventory with normally Cecil, what, 90, 120 days, something like that?
90 days usually.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then probably a final. Mm-hmm. So we do have, you know, these documents. But sometimes we find that, like I said, the documents don't really line up with actions that have been taken. But how do we know that?
Mm-hmm.
How do we know? Well, the way we learn that is obviously if we really kind of smell a rat here and we think there's something not going wrong, going right, we would have the right to request from the executor the actual bank statements or the ledgers showing all the money that the decedent had as of the date of death or assets that they had. Obviously, the bank statements are not going to lie.
Mm-hmm.
And then usually there would be an estate account, so we'd be able to see the money that came into the estate account. And then we would be able to get the bank statements, ledgers, cancel checks, so on and so forth.
Well, who would be requesting this? Somebody who's
a beneficiary under the will
is
asking for that from the executor. And if the executor...
Or if there is no will, an heir...
Mm-hmm.
Right.
An interested party,
mm-hmm.
which would be an heir at law, a relative that would be entitled to inheritance under intestate succession or by statute.
Okay.
If there's a will, then of course it would be the named beneficiaries in the will. And again, Ben, as we've said so often in the program, what we're talking about right now is that big word, fiduciary. Fiduciary can be the agent under the power of attorney, known
right.
as the attorney in fact.
Mm-hmm.
It can be the executor. It can be the trustee. Fiduciary is a larger, you know, kind of Roman numeral one category of people who are holding money, holding assets for the benefit of another.
Right.
And they, of course, have a standard by which they must govern themselves and they must control and manage those assets.
Mm-hmm.
They have to act reasonable with those assets. They cannot act in any way that would be ruled to be or considered to be self-dealing, anything of that nature. Now, as we've talked about so many times on the program, Ben, you know, these cases usually consistently come out of allegations of misappropriation of funds relative to a power of attorney,
mm-hmm.
or the changing of accounts. And of course, the famous payable on death, time on death accounts, joint with right of survivorship accounts. Those are all so very ripe for litigation consistently over and over and over and over again. Each week we see cases concerning these designations that are made at stock brokerage houses,
mm-hmm.
bank houses, banking institutions, et cetera, relative to, you know, a child putting their name on an account, payable on death or time on death.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then that account passes to that one child when in fact the will passes equally to two or three or four children.
Right.
This creates a real problem, as we have said.
Okay.
And so, here we are, someone is coming in and seeking advice concerning, you know, what do I do? Where do I begin?
Yeah, what's the process for challenging this? I think that'd be...
It depends on whether we're mm-hmm. dealing with a will that we have a question about or a trust that we have a question about or,
mm-hmm.
or a deed.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when we're dealing with a will, that's a set statutory procedure called a will caveat. We've talked about that before on the program.
Mm-hmm.
There are mechanisms in which you can challenge a deed in the event it was procured through fraud or undue influence, but that's very...
Somebody shows up with property in their name before the person died and they
that's
think
right.
it's... That's yeah,
right. Undue influence, okay. fraud, incapacity, those type things, but that's it's pretty narrow in North Carolina as far as being able to challenge a deed.
Mm-hmm.
The funnel gets a little more narrow when you're dealing with a deed as opposed to a will. When you're talking about a trust, if assets were put in a trust and the trust was signed during a questionable period of time, maybe the individual lacked capacity or was under undue influence, you know, fraud type situation, real similar to the will type
mm-hmm.
situation. So that's kind of those type challenging of documents. But then when you get into challenging or questioning the acts of the fiduciary, which is really more in line with what we're talking about today. There's multiple actions that can be taken. If we think that, for example, that the estate was just not administered consistent with the will,
mm-hmm.
then a lot of those type actions, when we're just asking for a proper estate administration under the terms of the will, can be handled through motions just at the clerk level.
Mm.
But if we're getting into maybe a breach of fiduciary duty,
right?
We think you breached that. You put the money in your pocket. You know, these kind of things. Even maybe after the fact, and there's nothing left in the estate.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times we're having to file, you know, those actions, breach of fiduciary duty, or breach of certain statutes with regard to administration of the estate. I've got an example that I'm currently dealing with.
Okay,
we can
I'll
talk
what,
about
we'll,
in a minute.
We'll take a break and then we'll come back and look at that example too. That helps us understand those things. But your calls are always welcome too. You may have had this situation. You want to call in and ask how maybe best to handle it or maybe how you could have handled it differently. 800-818-2255, 247-7282-353-4674. As we continue with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. And they're on the web too at harvellandcollins.com. Hey, welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And Wes, you had an example.
Right, we were talking about, you know, potential breach of fiduciary duty cases or situations where we think the estate wasn't administered properly and those
mm-hmm.
type things. In a case I'm dealing with currently, it's a really interesting situation. A young man out of South Carolina called me, and he indicated that his grandmother had died years ago, and that he and his brother were beneficiaries under grandma's mm-hmm. estate. And his mother had just recently died. And he indicated that he was going through his mother's documents in South Carolina and found two checks, one for $51,000, another for $25,000, one made payable to him, the $51,000, another made payable to his brother's estate, who happened to die during the pendency of the grandmother's estate administration.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Are we following all that?
Yeah.
And found those in his deceased mother's, excuse me, important papers. Original checks.
Mm-hmm.
Never negotiated. Never endorsed. Never cashed. So his call to me was, you know, I know this has been a long period of time, Mr. Collins, but, you know, it looks like my mom got this money from her brother, who was a minister in the estate, and just never gave it to us.
Mm.
So obviously the initial knee-jerk question back to him is, that's very unusual, because usually if you have $76,000 worth of checks,
right,
you don't put them in a drawer. Yeah. You know, you're going to give them to the right person. They're going to get negotiated, so on and so forth.
She didn't write them, though.
She didn't. No, they came from the estate of the deceased grandmother.
Right.
All right. So in general, his question was, what can we do about this? Well, first of all, you know, we look at how long it's been. Okay. There was a significant amount of time, but this issue just came up. The grandchildren just learned about it. And when I asked the question of the young man who called me, this is very unusual, why would your mother have kept these? The explanation I got was, you know, my mother was kind of like that. And you have to realize her son, my brother, had just died too.
Mm-hmm.
She was really in mourning and probably would have been the type of person who would have just tucked these away and forgotten about them. That's just who she was.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Right. So
she was the administrator of the grandparents.
She was not the administrator. She was just the parent of these two.
Oh.
Her brother was the administrator.
And what?
Her brother gave the checks to her.
Oh, I see.
Give these to your kids.
Oh, okay. Instead of going right to the kids themselves.
Exactly. So as an illustration for what we're talking about today, mm-hmm. I mean, the question would be, you know, what did you do next, Mr. Collins? How did you go about addressing this? And of course, what we did first is we got, just like I said a second ago, a copy of the entire estate file.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to see all the inventories, all the information with regard to purported disbursements from the estate, the phone number, contact information with regard to the administrator of the estate, executor in that case.
Mm-hmm.
And right off the bat, we did notice that the two checks that were dispersed were not shown anywhere on the estate filings.
Hmm.
Didn't show that this check on this date and this amount had been written.
Hmm.
It showed that there were some checks that were written that were close to that amount and close to that date, but not. It just wasn't consistent, so that kind of raised an issue. So, of course, the next thing you do is you just contact the executor and you ask some questions about it. And I sent a letter to the executor. He calls me back. I talk with him. Long story short, he's not real helpful, and he's a little bit defensive mm-hmm. About the whole situation. So then you get to the issue, okay, the executor's not going to help me very much. What do I do in order to get the documents from the bank? Like mm-hmm. I was just saying, hey,
right.
You look at the public record first,
because
everybody can look at that, the estate administration documents. And then, you know, we look at the bank records. Well, not everybody can get the bank records.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my client is just a beneficiary under the estate. So then you have to go through the process as the attorney to get standing, like you said,
in order
to get those documents. We can either request them from the executor, which we did, and he wasn't helpful and was defensive. And then secondly, we could reopen the estate here in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we reopen the estate, then potentially my client could be the administrator of the estate, even mm-hmm. though there was a previous executor. So I know this is getting a little bit complex, but let me just break it down here and conclude. So what we ended up doing is contacting the clerk of court, letting the clerk know about the situation, and the clerk said, yes, I'd be happy to reopen the estate because you certainly have a question here
mm-hmm.
about whether this they ever received what they were legally entitled to.
And where did the money go?
Where did the money go? And you can't get those bank records unless, hey, we open the estate. But what I need you to do, Mr. Collins, is to give the previous executor, the person who was the executor previously, the opportunity to come in and reopen the estate. And then if he does that, then we're asking for that information from him as the fiduciary, or potentially we then file a lawsuit against him and the estate in order to get those documents through a subpoena.
Right.
So the clerk, and the reason you call the clerk is because you want the clerk to be satisfied with what you're doing ahead of time, as opposed to just sending it over there and saying, hey, here's what you're going to do.
Right.
We kind of get on the same, the same page together. So we gave that executor that opportunity and he declined for whatever reason. So we then, reopened the estate, and now the grandson who contacted me from South Carolina is now the administrator of the estate. So he now has full standing to access all bank records. And I don't have an absolute conclusion to the case yet because we don't have the bank records yet.
But that's how you get there.
That's how you get there. And we are the estate now. Mm-hmm. So we can contact, it was Wachovia at the time, now Wells Fargo, get the documentation from them, follow the paper, find out where the money went.
So now the former administrator of the estate is now just a beneficiary?
Exactly.
He's
just a beneficiary, but he still has liability as a fiduciary, though, because he was a previous fiduciary.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back. Alvin is on the line. We're going to get to Alvin's question in just a moment. Hang in there, Alvin, and we'll get to you right after this here on a Coastal Daybreak and Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And remember, you can go online and hear past shows, get a lot of great information on their website, too, at harvellandcollins.com. And we'll have more to come in just a bit. Hey, welcome back to the program here. Let's Talk Legal. Alvin is on the line with a question for us. Good morning, Alvin. Thanks for holding.
Yes, good morning. I got a question or a situation I want some help on if I could. My mother's been in a nursing home over a year now, won't ever come home. Spent all her money down where insurance or whatever paid for it, but we still got her car. It's on my insurance, and I got two other vehicles on it, so it's pretty expensive. It's in my name and everything. I'm paying the insurance on it. But here about 2 months ago, my nephew's car broke down, still getting it fixed. He's came and got my mother's car without me knowing about it, driving it, stuff like that. And her daughter's driving it now, 16, 17 years old. I want the car sold, but my oldest brother's a power attorney. Hadn't got off his butt and done nothing yet. Wanted out of my name because I can't afford it. If something happens to that car, it's going to be me having to pay for it. And I'm not even driving it and stuff like that.
Before we run out of time, let's see if we can get to some
responses. Alvin, let me ask one question that's a bit off your question, then we'll get back to your question. Does your mom own any real estate, any land?
No, she divided it up before me and my brothers years ago.
Okay, very good. The reason I asked that question just for our other listeners is that if mom would qualify for Medicaid many times, notwithstanding the fact that she did in fact own land, but we wouldn't want to leave that in her name, as you probably know, Alvin, now that she is on Medicaid, because Department of Medical Assistance will seek a lien against that property when mom is no longer with us. Now back to the car a minute. Is the car titled in your name or in your mother's name?
Well, it's in her name, but like I said, I'm paying for the insurance stuff like that.
Can you just drop the insurance?
Well, absolutely.
You could, because, you know, without insurance, then that car is going to, you know, you're not going to be able to get a registration, and no one is going to be able to drive it. But, to allow that car to stay, and your mother is entitled to have one vehicle, so of course, and be qualified for Medicaid. So that, of course, was not a problem, but in terms of Medicaid qualification, but in terms of someone driving and the liabilities associated with the younger person driving your mother's car, I agree with you that that's just not a very prudent thing to be happening right now. Your brother, as the power of attorney, really should be encouraged to kind of bring that situation to some sense of closure.
Yeah, you have the right to stop the insurance, but you don't have to continue to pay those premiums. But I would tell you to put whoever's driving this, I think you said there's some family members that are driving,
right,
put them on notice. Let them know you're doing that. You know,
yeah.
And
they'll have X number of time to pick it up.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I reckon that's the best thing to do, just tell them whoever's driving it now, so look, I'm going to drop the insurance, and it's up to them to whether to put the insurance on their names or something.
That's correct. That's right.
Right.
Well, thank you all very much for your time. You've told me a lot. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Alvin. Again, this is one of those things that we do, out of love in the family. We don't want to make waves and things like that. But that's maybe a little tough love situation that just needs to be handled that way. Because otherwise, all the stuff that he owns is up for grabs.
Yeah. Another thing I would bring up about that is, I don't know what the value of the car is, but they did talk about the brother potentially selling the car using the power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And if she is on Medicaid, then and she receives, more than a couple $1,000s of money from the sale of the vehicle, then they kind of need to do a little planning with regard to how they're going to use those funds. Otherwise, her Medicaid would probably come to an end for a short period of time until they prove that they spent that money down under $2,000.
But the car could remain titled in her name.
It could.
Somebody else could own the insurance, though.
It could, absolutely.
Yeah.
She's entitled to have one vehicle. I think he mentioned there were maybe a couple vehicles.
He has a couple.
He has a couple. Okay, I got you. So just that one vehicle is allowed under the Medicaid laws. But, if you have an asset that's a non-countable asset, which, there are some assets under the Medicaid laws that are non-countable.
Mm-hmm.
Like Cecil said, sometimes depending on how your real estate is titled, it could be a non-countable asset. Or if you get an inheritance, for example, the funds that come to the person who is the Medicaid applicant or recipient will stop the Medicaid, and you have to report that. But if you plan ahead, if you receive those funds, let's say at the beginning of the month, you can typically spend those down within 30 days and it not upset your Medicaid. And there are things you can spend those down on instead of paying for the nursing home care itself.
Right.
It's a whole list of things. A good competent elder law attorney can help them with that if that's an issue. It might not be based on the value of the car.
Okay. Again, if you want to find out more information, too, you can make that first free consultation with Harbell and Collins, Attorneys at Law, 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City, 252-726-9050, 726-9050.